And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness. The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
That's the kind of laugh I got now. So there'll be no tomfoolery on your end, or I'll cough up a lung.
This was Dean Haglund explaining why he's playing hurt. He's at the end of a long Michigan cold. I am Phil Lairness. I may still be inebriated. We are going to start with some live events, both current and future, that pertain to what we are up to. And I'll start with why I was drinking.
And that's right there.
And that was because last night was the final night of the Mad Hatter Gin and Tea Party, which the immersive theater show that Lily has been doing all summer, since late spring. And darn if she didn't realize that this is the show she's done the most in her career.
Wow.
And honestly, this is the one where she would be absolutely happy doing this every day for the rest of her life. And what a success. You know, like, immersive theater was starting to emerge in LA, but there's a lot of people that still don't know about it. And it snuck up on a lot of people. And I think, my God, something like 10,000 people came to see this thing. I mean, that's for a theater that holds not even 40 people. That is a lot of people to
cycle. That's a lot of people
in and out of there. It just opened in London. It originally played in New York. It just opened in London. They're going to be opening it in, I think, Chi-Town. And I think Lily may just get involved with making sure this thing comes back here to L.A. Did I mention that she would do it for the rest of her life if she could?
Yeah, you did. That's a thing. Now, 10,000 people, that's a lot of shows, and that's a lot of people. Then why are they stopping it? That's what I'm not understanding. Oh,
well, there is a really, really good point. I guess leave them wanting more would be the answer. It may also have to do with the seasons. I mean, the pop-up venues and you know, the terms, you know, you rent these places, right, for a certain run, and they did extend. But I would imagine that the more you extend, the more, I'm speaking off the top of my head. I don't know.
I hear that. You're still drunk. But, you know, you think about Sleep No More, the interactive pseudo-Shakespearean event in New York City.
Right.
That took up four, five stories of a warehouse over in Chelsea. They now bought that building. They run the restaurant. It is a full-time, ongoing concern. And still an amazing success story of interactive theater doing so well as to buy real estate. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Well, yeah. But let's remember that it costs so much to put that together that they couldn't even afford advertising. It was all word of mouth for like the first year, and they needed it to run long just to break even. So that was built into the mix. Here,
right.
I'm not joking about this. They needed this to run at full capacity, you know, like sold out shows for probably 2 weeks, and they were in profits.
Wow, really?
You know, yeah. So, they made a lot of money. This group. Now, that's not to say that every dollar after the first couple weeks is just sheer profit, because every show they have overhead they have to pay. But
right,
it was these were event people that produced this, not theater people, so they know how to make money.
Anyway, they're in life.
But so that was great fun, and you know what I learned, Dean. This is kind of interesting. A couple weeks ago, with my friend Steve Lem, who you know, one of my groomsmen there at the wedding, he and I partook of a couple downtown LA bars that we had never been to before. Because you know, he's a bar habitué. He's an aficionado. That guy. He helped find us a spectacular fallback location for the bachelor evening.
That's true.
So we went to Bar Franca in downtown LA, and then to The Varnish, which is in a secret location. You have to enter through Kohl's, and you really have to know where you're going, because it's tough.
Now, but I've been to The Varnish, but this Bar Franca.
Okay, this is cool. It just celebrated a year. Very cool. Okay. And I am acquainted with the young man who was the bartender that night. And anyway, the reason I bring this up is that I was telling him about Lily's gin and tea party, and imagine that, you know, these gin cocktails mixed with tea. And he, who knows a thing or two about whatever he studies. I mean, he approaches bartending like an engineer. It's ridiculous that a man that young, still in his early to mid-20s, should be such a perfect mixologist. But he is. And he explained that the gin and tea concoction was indeed the first mixed cocktail.
Really?
And that is where we get the word punch from, because I think, and again, this is many, many drinks ago, he explained that it was from the word punch, panch, P-A-N-C-H, and it was, among other things, a mixture of teas and gin. So you learn a little something about history when you go to the bars. My knowledge of history had suffered all these years where I wasn't drinking as much as I used to. And what's terribly exciting is I wasn't the only one to come home from this show drunk last night. Lily Holloman drinking.
What?
And at one point announcing during the evening, I'm going to take up drinking again.
So. Oh my God. A teetotaler with a touch of champagne is all I know ever known her.
And now she's a gin and teetotaler. And
wow,
see what you did. All right.
The gin teetotaler.
So that's what I was doing last night. And friends, anyone within the sound of my voice, if you're going to be in the Los Angeles area on Sunday, October 6th, I'm hosting another one of these wild variety shows that I seem to do every year. This year, the theme, set in 1953, it's going to be almost period appropriate entertainment and mostly a tongue-in-cheek celebration of the great explorer Leif Erikson. It's Leif Erikson Day 1953.
Ah, fantastic.
And if you're like me, when you're celebrating Leif Erikson, the old traditions are the best traditions, so we're going to revive as many of them as we can. It's going to be big fun, magic, comedy, music, dance, ventriloquism, history,
what?
Storytelling, drama, maybe even romance, though that would take place out in the audience, and maybe even a little bit more special guests. So it's the Leif Erikson Day, 1953. People can find more at EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com. EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com. Now, Dean Haglund, I want to know two things. Apropos of live events, I want to know about live appearances you will be making, if you have any on the agenda, and I want to know the latest status of Gravity Hole.
Very good. Some live events coming up for me will be, of course, if you are in the sound of my voice in Detroit, the Motor City, I will be at Go Comedy on Nine Mile Road, October 31st, Halloween night, doing a special scary episode of the one-man improvised episode, The X-Files. So that's Halloween night in Detroit, if you have nothing else to do.
That sounds like a great way to celebrate Halloween.
Right?
Yeah.
And I got to say, decorations are already up on a lot of lawns here where I am. I didn't realize that you actually started decorating an entire month beforehand. So we are way behind. We still have our summer deck painting going on. So, and then I will be doing some of Friday and Saturday night shows at Go Comedy. Of course, they have the showcase special improv showcase comedy show. I'll be guesting in a couple of those groups. So, I haven't actually picked any specific dates yet, but I'm assuming next Saturday I'm going up. Let's say that.
And so Go Comedy, people can find the information. We'll link to it. But again, where is the Halloween show?
The Halloween show will also be at the Go Comedy Theater. All right. And that's on Nine Mile Road.
So Go Comedy for all your comedy needs.
Exactly. Go to Go Comedy for all your Go Comedy needs. I think that's why they call it Go Comedy.
And where are we with Gravity Hole? I mean, we were talking a big game, and then all of a sudden at the last minute, there will be no show.
No. We are going to be doing we're just getting all our schedules aligned, and we're bringing in a couple of people to help promote. So we're getting all our ducks in a line so that we come out swinging. And swinging we will be Sunday. Sunday will be another live episode of Gravity Hole, and hilarity will ensue. And you can see all the back shows of Gravity Hole at gravityhole.com.
All right. Well,
archive shows.
I'll follow up with you on that. And now, more than I even thought when I sat down early this morning to set everything up, we've got a bunch of celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Let's start with pioneering journalists, shall we, Dean? Pioneering journalists for 500.
Very good.
Cokie Roberts,
I know him. That's long off the radar, actually.
So you thought, you're basically trying to tell me you already thought she was dead.
Yeah, I'm saying that.
So she was only 75. I mean, that's really it's not that old, but it's also, indeed, it seems like she kind of retired young in a way. Given what a fixture she was. I mean, she was known for her work on NPR's Morning Edition, as well as co-anchoring ABC News This Week with Sam Donaldson and Cokie Roberts. And always as a panelist seemed kind of a palliative cure in certain ways to Sam Donaldson or to, I remember even Buchanan. Remember who eventually made a presidential run? She was often a counterweight on some panel shows to him. She began working at NPR in the radio network's early days, joining in 78, helping shape the growth of the network as she covered politics as a congressional correspondent. And, she was considered one of the founding mothers of NPR. So a groundbreaker, a trailblazer, not only for being a woman pursuing that career path, but also for really creating the imprint that would be NPR and their news coverage. She came to her understanding of politics kind of naturally, Dean, as she was the daughter of Hale and Lindy Boggs, both of whom were U.S. representatives from Louisiana.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, she grew up literally as a kid would play in the halls of Congress. And she was the best-selling author of several books, including We Are Our Mother's Daughters and Founding Mothers. I've got a really funny story about one of her books, but before I get to that, she was widely honored. Truly, it's hard to overestimate what a legend of journalism she was. She was honored she was named literally, quote, a living legend by the Library of Congress in 2000. To me, like, Library of Congress is going to be apt to throw around willy-nilly monikers like a living legend. And
right.
I wonder now that she's not living, do they take it back?
No, she's just a legend. She's legendary.
She won 3 Emmy Awards. Perfect time to be talking about this. Emmy Awards were last night. And she won the Edward R. Murrow Award. American Women in Radio and Television named her one of the 50th greatest women in the history of broadcasting. More than 20 honorary degrees and a member of the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame. I heard an excerpt of her reading from one of her books, and it was kind of hilarious because, you know, she's reading about the importance of balancing work and family, and it's pitched very much towards women. But, you know, it struck me that, wow, I wish that this was pitched towards men, because why, you know, it'd be better for men if they understood the importance of not missing out on so many indelible moments. But it was in some ways universal and in other ways so specific to how she was raised, because she's stressing that you got to remember that there are many things in life where you only have one opportunity to witness them. You only have one opportunity to witness the birth of your child. You only have one opportunity to hold your sister's hand while her husband dies. You only have one chance to witness your mother get credentialed by the Pope.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yep. And I was gonna, or less than one. Maybe you have less than one opportunity to do that. That old chestnut, the credentialed by the Pope.
Right.
So the other journalist that I wanted to talk about, and I'm wondering whether you remember this person, because this is fascinating. This guy was a little bit of a hero to me when I was a little boy, if only because he had the most delightful name in journalism, Sandy Van Oker. Sander Van Oker is his real name, known as Sandy. To his friends, he was one of the most prominent political reporters in this country during the 1960s, was a White House correspondent and national political correspondent for NBC News in the 60s and 70s, and Dean, he was the last participant in the Kennedy-Nixon debates to still be with us. He was one of the moderators in those debates.
Oh, look at that. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't. You know, when you see those, you just see the excerpts. You never hear the moderator on those where Nixon looks unshaven and sweaty.
He was quite the deal. I mean, he was one of the first reporters in the years that would follow to publicly ask Kennedy to justify the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he's the one that dubbed Kennedy's coterie as the Irish Mafia.
So,
you know, you think about the 1960s, you think of politics in the 60s and 70s and all the upheaval and all the epochal shifts and iconic stories and moments. And he was front and center for so many of them. But that Kennedy debate, the Kennedy-Nixon debate, I don't know if we've ever spoken of this, but did you have to, in school for any reason, in any kind of media studies? I know it was Canada, but did you ever have to study those?
Study the debates?
Yeah, the Kennedy-Nixon debates.
No, we didn't have to study it, but it did come up from time to time in discussion, and often it was about image over substance, because apparently if you listen to the debate on the radio,
yes,
it sounds like Nixon wins. But if you saw it, because he was unshaven, he did not present himself to the camera well, whereas Kennedy looked like $1 million. And so if you saw it on TV, you thought Kennedy did better. But if you heard it, you thought Nixon did better.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. It's it's startling. And that was, yeah, that was a big reason why we were studying it there.
It's a shift. A shift in perception, really, and how a mediated image, the camera changes not just what you say, how you say it, how you look is now more important. We hear what we see. We hear what we see. We listen with our eyes, apparently. And so, yeah, I know this is, you could now draw that line to why an actor became president and then a reality star became president.
You can also draw a line in an odd way from what we're talking about thematically to why Star Trek would be so successful in my mind in some way, which is, of course, that Gene Roddenberry cuts his teeth on early television scripts, but boy, Star Trek, the original show, works as a radio play. If you just listen, as I did as a little boy playing on the floor while my mom is watching the reruns on this tiny little portable black and white television up on the kitchen counter, right. And I can't see the images, but it's still working. Wow. Working even better because I'm seeing what I'm hearing. I'm not limited by the budget constraints of an NBC show with low ratings in the late 60s.
Right. That's fascinating. I don't know if I've ever done that, just listen to the audio of the original series.
It's worth it.
I wonder if they even have that line.
And I think it's part of the reason that it did capture the imagination of so many young people. Who did not grow up with radio, obviously,
right.
But it operated on that way. We saw what we heard, and there are myriad examples of this to this day, right? I mean, in our movie, The Lady Killers, I remember one particular thing when people came up and complained after a screening about one scene going on too long. And I said, oh, you all think it went on too long? Yes, yes, many. How long would you say? Oh, several minutes too long. Several minutes too long. Okay, well, I'll look at that. And, I went home and timed it, and it was 17 seconds, the scene.
Right.
But they saw what they heard.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating thing. All right, we got to move on through this. Yeah. We're at the age, as I mentioned, I guess, Dean, where almost every week we've got to expect to actually know people that we're talking about in celebrity deaths. I knew Suzanne Wang, who was the host of Home and Garden Television's House Hunters from the show's debut in 99 through 2007. She was an actress and a comedian. Did you ever come in contact with her in that regard?
I don't think I did. I maybe saw her live at the Improv once years, but I never came in contact where we had a discussion in a play.
She had a recurring role as Polly Nguyen on Las Vegas, played Carol Chang on General Hospital, made appearances on shows including Criminal Minds, Two and a Half Men, one of my favorites, Boston Legal, of course. She won the Best Up-and-Coming Comedian Award at the 2002 Las Vegas Comedy Festival and the Andy Kaufman Award at the 2004 New York Comedy Festival. She had been battling breast cancer for 13 years, died of breast cancer at her home at the age of 56. I remember her as a comic, and when I met her, I mean, that's what she was pursuing, and it was right around 2002. It is interesting how from those kind of, I guess those aren't early days of show, stations like HGTV. HGTV was very popular in the 2000s, but our friend Jamie Kaler does a lot of the kind of light reality shows. Haunted Live, and he does stuff for HGTV. But really, the smarts that they have to go after people with real stand-up chops for those shows.
Exactly. Yeah, that can sort of deliver and be fun, fun-loving, and, have that right energy. Because you don't really... HGTV is not sit-down TV. I'm switching from one channel to another, and there's a likable feller. I like that guy. Let's watch this thing. So
now
that's how I watch my HGTV.
I think a couple of actors that we need to remember that you no doubt did meet or come into contact with. One of whom was Aaron Eisenberg.
Yes.
actor and filmmaker known most widely probably for his role as Nog on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
And the Ferengi.
Yeah, you, good friend, the character was a good friend of Jake Sisko on the show. You encountered him at conventions and things, I would
imagine. Yeah, more than one, and we would sometimes chat, email, hang out. Always a great guy, fascinating, conversationalist. You know, it was shocking. I did not know, and I guess it never came up, that he's had kidney issues since the age of 14. And, you know, you wouldn't know that talking to him because, man, he was full of it, full of life, lots of laughs, jokes aplenty, really great. Fans loved him. And, yeah, it was a bit of a shock, that one.
Jokes aplenty is the name we considered for this podcast.
Did we?
Yeah. So you say dealing with it since 14, but, I mean, he was born with only one partially functioning kidney and
right.
Received his first transplant at the age of 17. My God, dealing with that at any age, but that age, I mean, it limited his growth to 5 feet. He appeared nevertheless on TV shows, including Tales from the Crypt, Amityville, Evil Escapes, Parker Lewis Can't Lose, Wonder Years, General Hospital, guest starred on so many shows, repeating guest star role in The Secret World of Alex Mack, and in several films, Puppet Master 3, Streets, House 3, The Liars Club. But again, it was Nog, a Ferengi, that he played through all 7 seasons of Star Trek Deep Space Nine that not only would make him most widely known, but would be one of the real entrees for him into the world of conventions through which you met him. What is kind of cool is, the role called for him to act underneath a great deal of heavy makeup. But he was allowed to appear without makeup in one episode where he played a news vendor in that episode, Far Beyond the Stars. One of the great episodes of Deep Space Nine. And then he also guest starred as a Kazon called Carr in the Initiations episode of Star Trek Voyager. He was also host and producer of the Star Trek theme podcast, The Seventh Rule. He performed and directed in theater. He worked as a photographer. So really an interesting guy with a lot of different interests and creative outlets. He even opened his own gallery sometime around 2013, I think.
And then
in August 2015, he was once again diagnosed with kidney failure, received at the very end of that year a successful kidney transplant. 3 years after that, he eloped with his lady love, Melissa Longo. This was just last December. And now, Aaron, dead at the age of 50, and people who knew him really, really, really affected by this.
Yeah.
He, just seemed like a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah. It's really shocking, actually. It's so terrible. But anyway,
I just found out before we started recording, before we got on air,
on air? Why are we on air?
I don't know. Sid Haig died.
What? No.
Yeah.
He
was a fixture of blaxploitation films of the 70s, known for his role as Captain Spaulding in Rob Zombie's horror films House of 1,000 Corpses, Devil's Rejects, Three from Hell. Had a leading role on the television series Jason of Star Command. He was a fixture on so many, like every TV show as a kid that I would watch, from Batman to Star Trek, Mission Impossible, Gunsmoke, Rockford Files, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Get Smart, Fantasy Island, Sledgehammer, for crying out loud, A-Team, Fall Guy, Dukes of Hazzard. One of those guys who made his living, and when he would show up, I know that, it's that guy.
Exactly. And I would run into him at the cons as well and conventions. And I saw him just on his Get Smart appearance. He's kind of a bad guy breaking working for the Agents of Chaos. And I didn't recognize him because I only knew him in the later years, where he looked more like the House of Thousand Corpses, the clown, the killer clown. And I said to him at the airport, I go, "Oh, saw your Get Smart." He said, "Yeah, that show was so great." And Don Adams would keep the production crew together on the off season by booking commercials. So they would take commercials and have the same crew shoot commercials all during the break so that everybody could keep working and stay together. So that when they come back into production, it's not like you have to recrew the whole thing. So it's like, oh, that's a nice story.
You love Don Adams. I think it's safe to say. And yes. I believe that is the first time you've ever shared that story. That is an amazing bit of Don Adams lore that you'd been saving all these years.
I've been saving for Sid Haig, because Sid Haig gave me that Don Adams lore. That was Sid doing it. Sid started as a tap dancer, believe it or not. He was a tap dancing child prodigy, according to him. We had a long Van Nuys Flyaway. I think we were both going to the same con together. So
I do want to talk about his childhood and his start in acting. And then we'll save some of these celebrities for discussion next week. But because this just did drop, and there is something about his upbringing, his entree into show business that I just find fascinating and kind of unexpected. But and this is why I want to talk about this guy, because again, this is one of those actors, you know, Dean, that I love, because he can be so closely identified with certain projects. Even you so closely identified him with certain things that it surprised you, right, to see him younger, to see him on this comedy show. And but it's just proof that, like, one, this guy may never have become a household name, but you would recognize, oh, it's that guy. And becoming a household name in some regards is a product of timing and luck. But to have worked steadily for as long as this guy did meant he knew what the hell he was doing. And so I'm fascinated to find out about just the training that he had. And so he's born in Fresno, raised in an Armenian community there. He took his last name, Haig, as a stage name from his father's first name, Haig Mosesian. Who was an electrician. And he began his career somewhat by accident. His rapid growth, because he was a big guy, but his rapid growth interfered with his motor coordination, which prompted him to take dance lessons.
Is that why? I didn't realize that.
And, you know, I was thinking, I don't know, I don't want to psychologize, you know, Aaron Eisenberg, but, I mean, it would be fascinating, I'm sure. You know, here I am struck by, oh my God, how hard it is, what he had to go through with the kidney transplants at 17 and at that age. But he does seem to be a man who, whatever it was that he went through, Aaron Eisenberg, as we say in the violence prevention world, survived. He was a survivor. Look what you survived, right? He wasn't a victim of these things. He survived them, and they informed him, and the man that was born out of it was in some ways served by the experiences that he, and I love that he finds Star Trek, right? A show that is all about envisioning a future worth enduring things for. And and fitting into that universe so well, so full of heart. So Sid Haig, right? Like you're telling how he starts out as a tap dancer, but the reason behind it is, you know, this physical condition. And okay, you should take tap to you know, learn coordination, and it leads to this lifelong love. I mean, I could go really down the rabbit hole here, but it's just so fascinating and fun and heartening. He displayed a great musical talent, a great natural sense of rhythm, becomes a drummer, Dean Haglund, a drummer as a kid.
Yes, I did know that too, because we talked both about our drumming days and terrible bands we were in. So That's right. I forgot all about his drumming
background. As a teenager, he played on the single Full House with the T-Birds in 1958, which shot to number 4 on the charts. So he was already a charted musician as a teenager. All right. So he goes to high school, head of the drama department, was a former Broadway actress who had maintained some of her contacts in the business. So during his senior year, he was in a play that was produced, and she had some of her Hollywood friends come up to Fresno to assess the cast. And
the cast.
Dennis Morgan, who had been a big musical comedy star in the 40s, saw Haig and really encouraged him to continue his education in San Fernando Valley and to consider acting as a career. And 2 years later, Sid Haig enrolls in the Pasadena Playhouse, the school that trained such noted actors as Robert Preston, Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman, and his roommate there was Stuart Margolin, who I think we've remembered on this show in Celebrity Deaths, Angel on Rockford Files. And what a great pairing. That pairing makes so much sense. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just love that it's the Pasadena Playhouse. You know, to this day, it still goes on. Tessa Thompson, who I spoke about last week after I saw the Men in Black International, right? And she's so good in the Thor movies. Anyway, I first got to know her work because I saw her in a show at the Pasadena Playhouse.
Look at that.
And you still are seeing these people who are going to make just huge marks. So Sid Haig, what a delight.
What a delight. You know, that guy at Comic-Con would always, he wouldn't sit upstairs with the other stars. He booked a space on the main floor. And not only did he sell 8x10s and like the rest of us, he had his own brand of coffee and chocolate covered coffee beans that was designed for him by a coffee distributor in Florida. So this guy knew his stuff, knew his fans, loved his fans, and had quite a traveling show when he went to the conventions. Sort of outstripped all of us in terms of revenue and how clever he had it all set up. So, yeah, Sid Haig, he's going to be missed.
I wish you hadn't told me the story about the coffee at the moment that I was taking my last sip in my cup. I'm so bereft now. I'm doubly bereft. Like I want to go and talk to Sid Haig about these things, and I want more coffee. All right.
Right.
We've
got get Sid Haig brand of coffee as a memorial.
We've got so many other topics to get to. Our ongoing topic that began with a conversation about empathy, but about how we take in the information, how we take in our entertainment, how we, it all in some ways falls under this heading of a conversation that I was having with some nutritionists and people about, health maintenance. But this idea that how we take something in probably is the single most important factor in terms of determining what it will do to or for us, how we take it in, right? We want to eat the healthiest, most organic, the most natural, the most local foods we possibly can. Not always possible. And you know what? That's fine. Do the best you can. But how you take it in is really the most important element of it.
Right.
You know, and so I was thinking about that with movies, how we take these things in. What is it doing to us or for us? I had the wonderful experience before it's too late, before The Egyptian becomes a private screening room of Netflix, to go and see Bridge on the River Kwai. I had seen it projected at some point in my life. I own the Blu-ray. I think we talked about this movie when we were covering our top war films of all time. But on the big screen, Dean, what a different movie. And I know I sound like an old guy saying, oh, you should see these on the big screen and stuff. I'm just saying, for me, what a different movie it was. Because much as I love parts of it, you know, you feel its running time on at home. You feel the 2-hour and 41-minute running time. At some parts of it, the whole third act, for crying out loud, of that movie, the final hour of that movie, is after William Holden returns and finds the bridge. All that happens during that final hour, in terms of the plot description, is find bridge, wire bridge, blow up, wait to blow up bridge. That's the description, and it's an hour. It's an hour. And when you're watching it on the big screen, oh my God, the suspense of it.
Right.
That can get missed, lost on the small screen. And it's not just how I was feeling it. I was fascinated. It was like it thrust me back to being a little boy when I first went to the movies, and I spent as much time watching the audience as watching the film. But this was one of those times where I wanted to do it. And Dean, people sitting forward after watching this movie for more than 2 hours already, and they're sitting forward on the edge, literally on the edge of their seats, their hands over their mouths, their eyes wide. They're in such suspense. And if I ever knew that, I'd forgotten it in the many, many decades since I first saw that film on the big screen.
And
so it got me to thinking, you know, how many great, great, great movies as the years go on might lose their reputation in some regard because we're not seeing them the way that they were intended to be seen. You've pointed out before the timing, the complex timing of especially the early Marx Brothers movies, right?
Yes.
You see it with an audience and you suddenly get it. You realize, oh my God, these guys were amazing.
Right.
In terms of timing everything out, knowing where the audience laughs were going to be. I bring this up, I guess, just because I was thinking that, and I'm not imposing this rule on you. Hell, I'm not even going to impose it upon me. I just can't. There are some films where I sadly don't get the opportunity, which is becoming increasingly my rant, right? We ought to have the opportunity to see these films truly, however we, if that's the name of the game, people should get to see it however they want to see it. We should have that opportunity. I'm trying to all the films that are contending for my best of decade list to make sure that I not only can attest to how well they play on a big screen, but how well they play at home.
Right.
And seeing them in both, because far from saying that, like with the advent of VHS, it filmmaking took a hit. The quality of filmmaking did take a hit as a result of the blockbuster mentality, both blockbuster in quotes and blockbuster as a chain. Both those things affected how movies were made. But now, think about it. You need to make a movie that will play well
on
different platforms, different sizes of screen, etc. Which is why I think the overindulgence of close-ups, honestly,
is why. Is that right? That's because that plays on a small screen. A close-up plays great on a small screen, particularly your iPhone. Yeah, your wide shot, it gets lost. So don't watch Lawrence of Arabia on your iPhone is what the lesson there is.
So I'll have more thoughts about this, and then again, I dropped in some hints at some things I wanted to discuss last week, but we'll put them on the agenda for next week so that I can get to a post that was shared by our friend Yoshikato about the importance of failure. And I want to read this quote to you, Dean. There is so much in here, both thematically and textually, that screams Dean Haglund. So let me share this with you. You take it in and then tell me all the ways in which this resonates.
Okay.
Here's the quote. I did things in my 30s that were ignored by the world that could have been quickly labeled a failure. Here's a classic example. In 1974, I did a movie called Phantom of the Paradise.
What?
Phantom of the Paradise was a huge flop in this country. In fact, there were only two cities in the world where it had any real success. Winnipeg in Canada and Paris, France.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, let's write it off as a failure. Maybe you could do that. But all of a sudden, I'm in Mexico, and a 16-year-old boy comes up to me at a concert with an album, a Phantom of the Paradise soundtrack, and asks me to sign it. I sign it. Evidently, I was nice to him, and we had a little conversation. I don't remember the moment. I remember signing the album. I don't know if I think I remember or if I actually remember, but this little 14 or 16, whatever old this guy was, well, I know who the guy is now because I'm writing a musical based on Pan's Labyrinth. It was Guillermo del Toro.
No.
The work that I've done with Daft Punk, it's totally related to them seeing Phantom of the Paradise 20 times and deciding they're going to reach out to this 70-year-old songwriter to get involved in an album called Random Access Memories. So what is the lesson in that? The lesson for me is being very careful about what you label a failure in your life. Be careful about throwing something in the round file as garbage because you may find that it's the headwaters of a relationship that you can't even imagine is coming in your future.
Wow.
That was Paul That's Williams, fit. Of course. So.
That is amazing.
Now, you were one of those kids in Winnipeg.
Totally. I'm staring right now at my album of Phantom of the Paradise, the vinyl. I have it hanging on the wall here in my studio. I remember drawing that picture. I remember trying to find the Phantom outfit in my local Kmart to wear at Halloween. And of course, there was no merchandise with this one. And so I attempted starting in July to try and make a Phantom of the Paradise outfit. Of course, where do you find an all black leather jumpsuit with a black cape if that would fit a 10-year-old, however old I was? They didn't make that, is what I'm saying. So yeah, Phantom of the Paradise, be careful what you label a failure, because it wasn't a failure. That was an amazing movie. I still tell everyone it's an amazing movie. I went on a podcast in Australia, and I said, this thing's amazing. You got to see it twice, because the first time you see it, you go, oh, that's not very good. But then you see it the second time, and it amazingly, it transforms into a completely different thing. And they showed it on Australian television because I guess they heard the podcast and everybody just went, meh, must be a Canadian thing. Just like I said you would, and they didn't show it again. Damn you, Australia, I say out loud. So, yeah, I love.
You know what? But again, like he said, there was, and we know this, right? People who will create things. This argument of it is a failure. No, it's not a failure, right? Well, it's always in the eye of the beholder. And when you're the person who creates something, there will never be a shortage of reasons to believe it's a failure, no matter what it is, no matter how successful it is. I maintain, right, that Bob Zemeckis, after he makes Forrest Gump, believes he failed. He wouldn't speak about that movie for a long time. Indeed, the aim of it was a super sinister dark comedy, a scathing dark comedy. He did not achieve it. The aim. Instead, he achieved a crowd pleaser, which felt wrong to him up until the time when he finally speaks about it, which is when he's collecting his Best Director Oscar. Okay, but that's not even the first point. I use Forrest Gump because, at that time, 20 years ago, right, $700 million worldwide it makes, an astounding amount of money, not Titanic money, but Gone with the Wind money, for God's sakes, and it never made a profit, right?
Right.
That's one of those famous cases of, sorry, it never made a profit, which is kind of, in financial terms, being a failure. Now,
right,
that those numbers were, of course, totally manipulated, totally played, but it's how unhealthy this whole conversation is around success and failure. Mm-hmm. And, we've talked about this, how it's just... We understand the impulse to want to step back from our failures, to distance ourselves from our failures, or to be the first, right? Why do people self-deprecate Why can self-deprecation, which can be so charming, actually be really unhealthy? Because people will feel the need to pile on and inflict a wound in themselves before you get a chance to do it. It somehow hurts less if we're doing it to ourselves than if someone we don't know is doing it. But the result, of course, is, like we've talked about, you never know when what you've done means something to someone. And and why deprive their inspiration, their joy? You know, I will just say, I'll say this, and then I want to hear more about your reaction to what he said. But I've learned, one thing I've learned from my failures, is that I basically learned to stop caring about success.
Right.
That when it felt bad to me, my failure, interestingly enough, was almost always when I was tied to the idea of, oh yeah, this is about financial success. And then when it didn't work, it's like, oh God, what? I need to define success in different ways, right? Through exploration, how much am I connecting with? You know, what am I learning? On and on and on and on. But that's one of the big things for me. But because you love this movie so much, but also because you're engaged in so many different arts and you're well known for such specific things. Do you see something of yourself in this in what he wrote?
Yeah, absolutely. Do I see that? Because you could perceive that you are, I can't even think what's a failure, what isn't. But how the X-Files reaches across 25 years, and now there's a whole new generation that are watching it. It's like, how bizarre is that? How weird. And I teach, I'm teaching improv now here in Detroit, of course. And I'm telling my students something they've never heard before, which is, if you are truly improvising, if you are truly trying to go into the unknown, you will fail. There has to be failure. And if you're not failing, you are not improvising. You are just tagging the basis. And this, to me, is the very epitome of what Bandai said. It reached for something so unique, so visionary, and highly and stylistically entertaining. And it was a swing. It was a swing, and it connected with All of Winnipeg, I'll tell you. That was lined up. That played for 2 years, that movie. I remember everybody would sing this song in choir. For crying out loud. Oh, anyway.
I love that you coined a term, inadvertently, failuring, because I love it. I think failuring ought to be a thing.
A thing.
You know, that you're including failure into the design in some way. And I think improv is perfect. I was having this conversation about improv where I was saying, there are improv shows that I've gone to where I've laughed a lot and not really found them interesting.
Yeah.
I've not found that. I would prefer a show that's interesting. Improv comedy.
Yeah.
I would prefer a show that's interesting to a show that's funny. And I mean, obviously, funny and interesting is the best, but go for interesting. And that's for me what I'm taking away from what you're saying, which is, people of real gifts, real talent, real ability, and real integrity that bring it to bear in this process are opening themselves up to failure. And if you don't, you are closing yourself off to many of the most interesting possibilities. And you're not supposed to be closing yourself off at all in improv, for crying out.
Well, I know. So you are, and it's the same with the audience too, right? The audience has to also experience into the unknown, and a level of fear raises the release of the comedy, frankly. So the fear of failure, both on the performer's part and the audience, you're freaked out. If this whole show is going to fall apart in front of you, And when it doesn't, when it magically somehow reconnects or comes together, the laughter is often the laughter of relief. Good God. Thank God they pulled that out of a nosedive, you know? So it's to really go for it is to find a new level of laughter that you don't find just trying to design a joke per se. So
I watched a one of these TED Talks and it was about innovation in Silicon Valley. But
right.
But one of the big takeaways for me that was fascinating is something that we kind of talk about from in different fields. But you know how we say, like, the dream of creative expression knows no age limit. Has no shelf life. So many people we've remembered in celebrity deaths don't even come to the thing that they're going to be most remembered for until very much later in their life. And yet, increasingly, we have this idea that so many different things are a young person's game, right? And one of them is tech. And so it was fascinating to me to hear this thing where there was this big study done, and the majority of people thought that the average age of a tech titan founding this, you know, a groundbreaking iconic company, that the average age of the founder was in their 20s, whereas in reality the average age was almost 50. And so I thought two things were fascinating, right? One is this fact that, yes, older people are the mavericks, are the groundbreakers, because they had to have failures under their belt. They needed to learn when to zig, when to zag, right?
Yeah.
And then the other element of it is how this myth has built up in terms of popular belief surrounding it. Isn't that fascinating?
It is fascinating. And I don't know how that myth got built. Is that... that's the story we want to hear, or is that just the youth culture holdover of the worship of the youth?
Oh, now we could go down a rabbit hole. Is it the story we want to hear? I would say yes, because it might be the story that you fear the most. But of course, as we talk about, where there's fear, there's desire. It's got to be what we want, but why is it the story that we want? I think in some cases it's the story that we want because parts of us want to know, it's too late for me. How many people say that? It's too late for me. And it's like, God, what they want is me to agree with them at this moment and say, yep, it's too late for you. Why? Because that alleviates us of the responsibility we feel for the gifts we've been given and the ideas that we have? Maybe. I don't know. But I didn't want it to go down quite that potentially depressing a rabbit hole. We've got a couple minutes left. The Emmy Awards were last night, and there's so much television. I want to ask about what you've been watching. I want to share. I finally sat down to really try and watch a Ken Burns documentary. He's done a 16-hour thing on country music, and I love so much of the music, and I'm several hours in waiting to hear some of the music. And, I mean, how many times do I have to be told who brought the fiddle to America? I mean, for fuck's sake, tell me what you're going to tell me. Tell me, then tell me what you told me. Don't tell me what you're going to tell me 50 times and then tell me 50 times. Jesus Christ, an editor, man. But I don't want to talk about that right now. I want to talk about three female-driven shows, especially in the wake of the Emmys and in the wake of some of the most heartfelt speeches, which was about equality in the workplace and equal pay and equal representation. But one is the big winner last night, the surprise winner in a lot of comedy categories, a show called Fleabag. From the BBC. Is this a show that had been on your radar that you'd been watching?
Yeah, no, I haven't been watching it. It's on my radar to watch. I haven't had a chance to just sit down and get into this. But all my echo sound chambers called social media, everybody's loving this thing. So I was curious and was going to sit down, and now I'm even more curious.
I starts as a one-woman Fringe Festival show, Edinburgh Fringe. And so that was, again, one of the reasons I thought about you. And, you know, what a fascinating origin story for this for this show. So we will give that a watch, and we'll talk about it. I've heard, now, I think all of it became available on Amazon, and so it becomes this just cause celeb overnight here. But it had two seasons, series, they would call it, in England. And from what I've heard, the second one is, and even during the acceptance speeches last night, the young lady who created it and stars in it credited Andrew Scott so good as Moriarty, of course, in the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock series, and who very well may end up on at least one entry on my Best of the Decade list. But his character gets introduced, and it really changed everything. The dynamic of the show and really improved it, but we'll look at this in the future. A show that is new that may get Emmy love next year. I don't know. I don't feel that it necessarily warrants it, but is a Kirsten Dunst vehicle called On Becoming a God in Central Florida. This is a Showtime series, and. And what I wanted to bring up about it is Kirsten Dunst, I think, you know, as in a way to promote this, got a star on the Walk of Fame. And you know how they'll, you know, studios will sponsor it at the time a product is coming out. So it's part of the you know, the advertisement for a new show or a new movie or a new album. And so she gets a star. And the Hollywood Reporter reports on this by saying Kirsten Dunst, best known for playing Spider-Man's girlfriend, gets a star on the Walk of Fame. And I couldn't believe, I had to like check the calendar several times to make sure that this was 2019, that was the description. You know that I hate the phrase best known for, because indeed you don't know her at all from that. Most widely, most popularly known, of course, but you want to really get to know a performer, get to know their passion projects, maybe get to know things that have nothing to do with acting at all. Maybe they paint, maybe they teach improv comedy. That's how you get to know more about who they really are, right, than this role that they played. But this is Kirsten Dunst, who I would argue is one of the landmark defining actresses of her generation on, you know, on a wide array of projects, both on the small screen, Fargo, for crying out loud, season two, unbelievable work. Lars von Trier's Melancholia on the big screen. Yeah. Going back to even when she was a kid, films like the Watergate parody Dick. I mean, she has a body of work that is incredible. She's doing wonderful work on Becoming a God in Central Florida. It's not her fault that the approach is so arch that it's missing its satirical target. It so wants to be a blistering satire, and it's kind of lifeless. It would have been much better to do this as a serious, straight ahead exploration of her character. She's the strength. Go with your strength, right? And who knows?
Yeah.
Shows can course correct, and they can find their strength. Fleabag may indeed be one of them, by all accounts. But I just was stunned, Dean, and Hollywood Reporter is not some, you know, it's not some
fly-by-night
blog site. It's not, you know, I mean, this is one of the papers of record, supposedly, in the industry. And this is how we think of, really, one of our great treasures, Kirsten Dunst, best known for playing Spider-Man's girlfriend. That that article fails the Bechdel test, for crying out loud.
That's right. The headline does in itself. Yeah.
And finally, I don't know if I shared this with you, but you know, there was the second season of Big Little Lies, and it did not get any Emmy love. The first season got Emmy love, and the second season lacked focus. It really, as I said to you, I enjoyed certain parts of it. Meryl Streep was delicious fun, But Laura Dern got much more to do, and she's always spectacular. She, to me, is one of the treasures that we have as an actor. But the show just lacked focus, lacked narrative thrust that explained why it existed in the first place. I wondered if that was because the first season hewed closely to the book. Maybe the second season didn't. But I don't know if I've shared this with you, but I finally got what I think is my answer to this question.
Oh.
Which is, the first season was entirely directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, the filmmaker behind like the Oscar-winning Dallas Buyers Club. The second season was directed entirely by Andrea Arnold, a woman who was really championed by the female cast. Only it turns out it wasn't really directed by Andrea Arnold. David E. Kelly and Jean-Marc Vallée picked her because she seemed to have a style that was simpatico with what Jean-Marc Vallée had initially created. But she's not interested in coming and just aping somebody else's style, right? And so they say, no, do what you do. But they've already picked someone, as you would hope they would, who has an affinity for that kind of material. But they actually saw, no, she has a kind of a parallel to Jean-Marc Vallée's approach in season one, so this is a good fit. All right.
Right.
I'm fine with all of this to that point. What they don't tell her, or the female stars who are also, oh, by the way, executive producers, is Jean-Marc Vallée isn't directing this because he's busy doing another show, but he's going to come in and do the editing.
Oh.
Yeah. So yeah. Andrea Arnold is directing every episode, but and this is the reason why directing for television is in many ways a big different ball of wax than directing for film. You right. often, as a director in television, don't have anything on a weekly series, on a recurring series. You often don't have anything to do with the editing. And with the creation of the style that's already set. Or with the editing that is done outside. But this is this case where, yeah, no, the man is still really going to ultimately be making the key decisions as the storyteller, and we're not going to let the woman that we're claiming to give free rein to even know about that up front.
Well, yeah. Are you seeing it as that, or are you seeing it as wanting to control tone and timing and
maybe, but in this era, how tone deaf a move is that?
Yeah, that's true, right?
A show written by women, driven by these female stars, produced by these women, adapted by David E. Kelly, and it's him and another man saying, well, here's what we're really going to do.
Yeah.
But ultimately, is there any surprise that I felt this whole time? Where's the focus of that first? What?
Yeah, right. Well, you took the wind out of my sails. Here we had a lovely show, and now, way to go.
I think it ebbed and flowed. I mean, there is no... you're making me feel like I failed in certain moments, but there is no failure. The failure may be planting the seeds of our further success. We may indeed be failuring, Dean Hagland.
You're failuring up.
Failuring up. All right. And we left many good topics on the table for next week. You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour on Blog Talk Radio and more episodes. I think all of our first year and all of our most recent year are now available at chillpackhollywood.com. We just have to fill in the 10 years in between. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes.
Yes. Subscribe. I didn't even write a review on iTunes.
What could be more fun? Really?
Yeah. Nothing.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. How can they
do that? We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. And they can write us, can't they, Phil?
ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. That is our preferred method of you reaching out to us. Yoshi shared that post via private messenger on Twitter. I mean, this may have come in like 18 months ago because I don't know. There used to be a thing with private messages on Twitter. Okay, yeah. That took off like wildfire. So chillpackhollywood at yahoo.com. Like us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Until next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.